Genesis chapter 23, beginning in verse 1, we read, Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abram went to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abram rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The Hittites answered Abram, Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead. Abram rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land, and he said to them, If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat me, Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place. Verse 10. Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, of all who went in at the gate of his city, saying, No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field. I give you the cave that is in it, and the site of the sons of my people I give to you. Bury your dead. And then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, But if you will hear me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead. And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out to Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. Verse 17. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites before all who went in at the gate of the city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for a burying place by the Hittites. So that's our reading for today.
On first reading, this chapter may be one that you'd be prone to skip over. It's one of those chapters similar to a genealogy where it's like, what, did Jason really just read that? That's what we're going to be studying today. So bear with me in this. I wanted to go through it because for whatever reason, and hopefully we get to the bottom of some of that, God saw fit to include an entire chapter about this strange exchange between Abraham and the Hittites getting a burial place for his wife. So my goal here is to try to walk through it carefully, teaching what the text actually says, and then try to find some application. So that's how we will run our time this morning. I'll teach through it, and then I'll try to give you a few ways to apply this text. That's my hope and goal. We'll see what I can squeeze out of it, okay? So pick it up in chapter 23, verse 1. We have this. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So Sarah dies. Sarah dies. Abraham's faithful wife of many years finally dies. She's 127 years old. In fact, she's the only woman in the whole Bible that her age of her death is given to show how important she is to the story of God. We don't even know how old Eve is when she passed away, but we do know about Sarah. She is perhaps the most important woman of the Old Testament, as her husband is likely one of the most important men, Abraham, of course. So this is significant that Sarah, who birthed Isaac, the son of promise, has now met her end. And questions surround this end. Is it what it's supposed to be? Has she achieved what she needed to achieve in her life? Would Abraham review her death and ask the question, have we achieved what we're supposed to achieve in this life? I think death of any sort or kind will bring those questions very quickly to mind. Death is something that's often not planned for, but will very quickly at any moment find its way through a phone call to us or a text message. Somebody's died. The dramatic has happened, and very quickly after the emotion begins to wane, the questions come to the surface. Was everything accomplished that should have been accomplished? Was my life worth it? And certainly Abraham would have questions such as this, but the only thing that we know about it is that it says he weeps. He weeps. It says he comes and he weeps. This is the only time we see Abraham weeping in Scripture. We knew that he laughed when he heard about the promise of his son that was coming. And now we have the opposite end of the spectrum. We have Abraham weeping. He mourns. He cries. He feels the pain of the situation. And we also get the sense, interestingly, it says Abraham came to mourn. We get the sense that he wasn't there. So it adds another layer to the story that Abraham wasn't there when she died, it appears. He may have been dwelling in Beersheba. If you go back to Genesis chapter 22, that's where we find him settling. So he may have been there, away, for whatever reason, we don't know. But nonetheless, not there when Sarah, his wife of all these years, has died. Let's move on to verse 3. It says, then Abraham stood up from before his dead, and he spoke to the sons of Heth, your version might say Hittites, saying, I'm a foreigner and a visitor among you. Give me property for a burial place among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. Abraham now seeks to respect Sarah in death, as he certainly did in life, and he wants to give her a burial, a proper burial. Problem is, and this is significant to this story, is that Abraham had no land. He did not have any land. And he says it here. He says, I'm a foreigner and a visitor. In other words, I'm just passing through. We know this signified Abraham's life. In fact, he's been traveling for some 60 years, some six decades, since God said to him in Genesis chapter 12, go out from your country, from your family, from your father's house to a land I will show you. He's still traveling. He's still traveling. He doesn't own any land yet. So Abraham speaks to the people that were local in that area near Hebron, the sons of Heth, it says. Again, it's extrapolated from the text that these are the Hittite people. Not that that name might mean something to you, but it does as far as Scripture is concerned. What is the origin of these people? Well, if you trace it back, you can look in Genesis chapter 10 and find out that the sons of Heth were sons of Canaan, who was a son of Ham, who was a son of Noah. And these individuals had followed this, you could say, aberrant line of Ham, who were disobedient to God in many ways, and now had settled in this area. And these are the people that Abraham is dealing with, the Hittites. More on them to come. Let's continue, though, in verse 5. And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places. None of us will withhold from you his burial place, that you may bury your dead. Now, it's very clear here that Abraham was in good relations with these Hittites, whatever we may know about them. He was in good relations. There was a mutual respect happening here. And even more than that, they call him a mighty prince. Or your translation may even say, a prince of God. So they recognize something about Abraham and his connection to his God and have a great respect for him. In fact, they offer, it says, the choicest of any of their burial sites. They freely offer this to him. So we see Abraham respecting the people and obeying their customs and ways, and we also see the people respecting Abraham here in this passage. There's no argumentation. There's no subversion. This is a free exchange between peoples. Going on, verse 7. Then Abraham stood up and bowed himself to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. And he spoke with them, saying, "If it is your wish that I bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and meet with Ephron, the son of Zophar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he has, which is at the end of his field. Let him give it to me at the full price as property for burial place among you." Now Ephron dwelt among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the presence of the sons of Heth, all who entered at the gate of the city, saying, "No, my lord, hear me. I will give you the field and the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of the sons of my people. I give it to you, bury your dead." We see Abraham here, starting at verse 7, bowing himself. A great amount of honor and respect is shown to the Hittite people in the way that Abraham is engaging them. He's going to proceed, it's almost excruciating detail in the text, proceed in a very orderly, lawful, according to their ways and customs, method of gaining this field. He does so publicly. He does so with names of people. Now clearly Abraham had his eye on this piece of land. He wasn't oblivious to it. It just didn't pop up in an offer. He had seen it. He had known about it. And it's a field in a cave. And he goes on to say that there's trees in the field around it. It's very specific. And it was owned by this gentleman, Ephron the son of Zophar, whoever he may be. But he goes down in history as the former owner of this. And we find out that he, if your translation hasn't said it already, is a Hittite. Again, critical to our story, I think. He's a Hittite. So they begin the business dealings. This is very likely a typical process of haggling and back and forth in the ancient Near East. But he would first offer it, Ephron, to Abraham as a free gift. He said, "Take it. Take it. Take the cave, take the land, and bury your dead in it." Very generous offer. Now, it's likely that the expected response of Abraham or the other party would be to say, "No, I will give you the proper amount," and the haggling would ensue. And that's where we go next, verse 12. Then Abraham bowed himself down before the people of the land again. And he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, "If you will give it, please hear me. I will give you money for the field. Take it from me, and I will bury my dead there." And Ephron answered Abraham and said to him, "My lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? So bury your dead." And Abraham listened to Ephron. And Abraham weighed out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearings of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, currency of the merchants. So what had followed was an estimation of the land. Okay, this is, again, this is very tedious, which I think is important for us, ultimately, in this text. Very tedious, this process that Abraham and Ephron go through. But Ephron makes it clear. He says, "Well, the proper price of this field is 400 shekels of silver." Now, it's unclear whether this was a very high price with the expectation that Abraham would come back with a counteroffer. Okay, I just got back from the Philippines. And every time you go to a market and ask someone, they very quickly recognize that I'm not a Filipino. And I get the American price. Okay. That's why I always sent Hannah up to make my purchases, so she wouldn't get that. But you get the American price, the high price, perhaps 2-3 times what it is actually worth. We don't know if that's what was happening here, but it's very likely. The expectation was that Abraham would come back with a counter offer. "Oh, I'll give you 200 shekels." He doesn't do that. He does not do that. He doesn't haggle, but he immediately says that he will pay the asking price, what the field was worth, the value of the field, at least in Ephron's eyes. So, verse 17, continuing on. The field of Ephron, which was at Machpelah, which is before Mamre, the field in the cave which was in it, and all the trees that were in the field, which were within all the surrounding borders, were deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went into the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, before Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded to Abraham by the sons of Heth as property for a burial place. Abraham now owns the land. The deal is done. And again, notice the extreme amount of detail that's put into the legality, the process. Everyone was present. It was done at the gate of the cities. It was deeded. It was given to him. Very clearly, Abraham owns it and is recorded for all of history as owning this piece of land. He paid the full price. It was a fully legal purchase, witnessed and approved by all. There's not a partial ownership. This is not a temporary, but it says very clearly it's a permanent possession for Abraham. The first time that he would own land in all his wanderings of 60 years. This is significant that Abraham would finally own land in the land of Canaan, in the land of the Hittites, because God had promised, among other things to him, that he would own this land. In fact, all of the land. Genesis 15, starting in verse 18, one of the promises that God gave to Abraham says, "The Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, and the Hittites,'" and so on. So what we have is this significant text here where Abraham, for the first time, begins to, you could say, cash in on the promise that he would own this land, that this would be a possession for him. A very small little bit, you could say, a seed of what it would grow to be, the whole land, but now he owns it. And we begin to see the significance of why so much excruciating detail is put into this text, that Abraham did get the land, and he did so legally, and he did so lawfully, and it was deeded to him because God promised that this would happen. And this is the very first time that he could look at part of it and say, "That's mine." And the very first time those around him could look at it and say, "That's Abraham's. That's his land." So that's the teaching. Rather brief. I tried to stick to the facts, but what I want to do now is try to draw out a few things that we can apply. I'll do my best here. I have maybe 7 or 8. We'll see how far we get. First one is this. Abraham's life is not a storybook life. Why do I say that? Well, let me remind you where we started today. Genesis chapter 23, verse 2, it says, "Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her." Abraham was a godly man. He was a godly man, but he was not detached from the realities of life. He wasn't detached. He experienced the high highs, the joys, as well as the difficulties, the pains of life. And I think it's always worth noting that even the godliest of godly in the Bible experienced great sadness, great trial, great difficulty. They were not delivered from the tragedies of life. Being a believer does not mean that you are delivered from the tragedies of life. You are delivered from other things, certainly. And you have someone to look to and follow in those tragedies, but you will still experience them. And I think we need to remember this. Although Abraham and Sarah's faith was great, it did not shield them from difficulty. So Abraham, once upon a time, laughed at the promise of his son, and now he would cry. There was a high, and now there would be a low. And I think we can expect the same out of this life, believer or not. Death of loved ones is something which is most certainly guaranteed for all of us, if you have loved ones at all. But it's something we very often do not talk about or would like to shield our minds from, isn't it? We understand this. I think it's good to recognize that our lives, even though they're in God's hands, that He is in control, that He has called us and written a plan for our lives, nonetheless, they're not Hollywood. They're not movies. This script was not written by man. It's not written by us. It's not written by me. It's written by God. And He will allow this to play out exactly how He wants it to. And we should never seek to romanticize this or glamorize it. Set ourselves up for expectations about this life that are idyllic. What a perfect Christian life should look like in our minds. Let me remind you that Abraham doesn't die for a couple chapters. Sarah dies at 137. Abraham's going to live for a few more decades. Spoiler alert, did you know he gets remarried? I had forgotten about that till I looked. But Abraham's going to live on. And while Sarah is the mother of our faith and Abraham's the father of our faith, nonetheless, Sarah doesn't die in Abraham's arms whispering, "I love you." He wasn't even there. This is a tragic situation. He wasn't there. He didn't know what was going to happen. God didn't reveal that to him. If we're honest, if we look at the history of the church and certainly the Bible itself, there are going to be plenty of things in our lives that just don't seem to fit. It's not idyllic. It's not perfect. And we can plan, we can prepare, we can pray. Nonetheless, there are going to be things that catch you off guard, that put you on your heels, that you can't plan for. But we have to trust that God is working in those things as well. Even in the very bad, the moments like Job that would force the question of, why? Why am I still alive? Why am I here? What are you doing, God? I think the bottom line is we should take nothing for granted. If anything in our life seems idyllic or along the lines of what we would like to see, well, hold on to that and be thankful for it. That's fantastic. It should give us a greater thankfulness for the things that we do have. The unknown of the future should make us very thankful for the things that we have now that we know. Second point is this. Abraham was honored by unbelievers. This is just a real simple point, but I want you to notice this, that even though God made it very clear that Abraham was going to possess this land that the Hittites have, that the Hittite people were anything but evil, anything but manipulative, anything but wrongdoing in any way towards Abraham. He was fully honored by them. Again, back in the text, verse 5, it says, "The sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, 'Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places.'" They were ready to give Abraham the very best that they had to offer. I don't know if we think about the world that much. I don't know if we ever expect that from unbelievers. But nonetheless, they do in this text. They're offering Abraham, the godly one, the best of what they have. And they go on to call him a mighty prince. Or again, your translation might say a prince of God. They have huge respect for Abraham. He didn't give that title to himself. Abraham didn't say, "By the way, you can refer to me as mighty prince moving forward." He doesn't do that at all. They choose this title for him. The people clearly had great respect for him. The non-believers had great respect for the believer in this text. And it seems also that they knew who his God was. There seemed to be, albeit vague, connection in their mind, that he was a mighty prince of God, of this God that he followed, and therefore he was blessed in certain ways that they couldn't understand or comprehend. But they knew that he had a relationship with his God. Nonetheless, they honored him. They respected him. I wonder if we expect quite the opposite from unbelievers perhaps too often. On the flip side, my third point is this. Similarly to this, Abraham honored the unbelievers. He did. Look at verse 7. It says, Abraham stood up and he bowed himself to the people of the land. He bowed himself. Now certainly you could say this was likely the historical norm, and I wouldn't dispute that. But nonetheless, the one they call mighty prince now bows like a servant before these people. He shows honor and respect and humility before them. And this is not the only time he bows. Several times in this passage, we find him bowing. Never disputing, only acting according to their customs. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 says, be subject to the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor supreme or to governors. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Honor everyone. And that's what we see Abraham doing. I wonder how many times, and I can only speak for myself, I look at the non-believing world and say they are deserving of no honor. And therefore, that's what I show. Honor everyone. Show respect where respect is required. So we see Abraham do this very quietly, very submissively, honoring the people, acting in humility. I think we need to remind ourselves often that Jesus said this, do to others as you would have them do to you. Oh, how easy it is to forget that, isn't it? Fourthly, Abraham did not seek to cut a deal. Abraham did not seek to cut a deal. Look at verse 14. And Ephron answered Abraham, saying, my lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? So bury your dead. And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, the currency of merchants. So Abraham would pay the full price for this land. You might say now you're stretching. What are we getting into here? Well, bear with me. Although it was likely expected that Abraham was going to haggle for this, he didn't do that. He would not go down in history being known as trying to get a deal on this. He would not be known as cheap. He would not be known as trying to get the best of the Hittite. He would not be known as trying to take advantage of the graciousness of Ephron either in this moment of sympathy. He pays the full price. I think this is notable. Something for us to consider. What are we willing to pay the full price for? Because Abraham here paid the full price for this tomb and was remembered for it. Now, I'm not saying we should just go around and spend all our money paying full price for everything. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying we shouldn't be frugal. I'm not saying we shouldn't spend carefully and be wise stewards of our resources. I'd be contradicting Scripture if that was the case, but I think we can slide into error if our primary goal in life is to make gains without any personal loss. We try to maximize the gain and minimize our personal loss. I wonder how often it's the case that we're guilty of paying full price for luxuries that we don't need, nor should we have, while at the same time trying to cut a deal with God and try to maximize our experience with God by investing the very bare minimum. Are you the type of person that always tries to get a discount or deal? You never want to pay the full price for it? Well, in the Christian life, if you want to carry this over to the spiritual side, some things you are going to have to pay the full price for. They're going to cost you the full price. Jesus made that very clear in his call to discipleship, that unless we were willing to give up all for his sake, we can have none of him. So I wonder how many times in our spiritual lives we're trying to cut a deal. We're trying to haggle with God. We're trying to get a cheaper price. We're trying to maximize our blessing and minimize our input. You say, I'm under grace. These things I get because I'm God's son or daughter. All the while he says, have you picked up your cross and began to follow me? Have you invested in me? Have you decided to pay the price that I have put on discipleship, which is all of your life? Or are you trying to argue your way out of it? Because Jesus said things like, hey, listen, I don't have a place to lay my head at night. If you're going to follow me, listen, I can't guarantee you're going to have a house. So if you demand that you need a house, you need a comfy place to live in, a home that you can go and lay in every night, well, Jesus might be saying, that's not going to work. If you're going to demand a job that gives you exactly what you want and gives you insurance and all the benefits and everything that this world could have to offer, say, I'm going to need that if I'm going to, you know, do this Christian thing because I need some padding, I need some help, I need something, I need some security. Well, guess what? Your odds with Jesus then. Because he's saying you might not get to have that if you follow me. In fact, if you're unwilling to give up the thought of that, the premise of that, you can't follow me. Everything must be on the table. There's no negotiations in the spiritual realm. God has clearly put the price in front of us. Furthermore, I will take this even down to matters of money. Because there are more than one occasion where Jesus talks about our foolish use of money and what we could be using it for. So if I could be base here and talk about money for a minute, listen to what Jesus said in Luke chapter 16. He said this, hey, it's true that the children of this world, meaning the unbelievers, are more shrewd in dealing with the world around them than are the children of light. They're more shrewd. And he says, here's the lesson. Use your worldly resources to benefit others and make friends. Then when your possessions are gone, they will welcome you into the eternal home. Jesus is saying, hey, listen, even the people of the world, they do a pretty good job with their money. They're doing better than you. Their money, their time, their resources. He's saying, my followers, listen, here's the lesson. Use that money for the kingdom. Use your possessions for the kingdom, so that you see a result on the other side. So I wonder, how many of us are trying to cut deals? Trying to get a discount on this whole thing called Christianity and following Jesus? And yes, even using our money for the wrong thing. To spend it on ourselves instead of the kingdom. My next point is this. Number five, Abraham kept on his feet throughout his life. He kept on his feet. Genesis chapter 23, verse 4, he says, I am a foreigner and a visitor among you. I'm a foreigner and a visitor among you. Now, we've all heard this and thrown around this phrase in our Christianity. This world is not our home. But Abraham actually lived as if this world was not his home. He exemplified it. For the 60 years that we've been following his story since he left Ur and Haran, he has never settled. He has not, until this passage, purchased any land. Let's remember where he came from. Initially, God called him. And God told him, in no uncertain terms, that he was going to bring him somewhere that he wasn't even aware of. He says, I want you to get up, I want you to go, leave your family, and I'm going to lead you to a land that you don't even know. I'm going to take you there. As the story progresses, God begins to clarify that, says his descendants would inherit the land of Canaan, which we've been talking about, land of the Hittites, etc. And now finally, after all these years, these decades later, he is beginning to see that promise play out. Only a small plot of land, only a small amount. But Abraham had walked in faith for decades, carefully pursuing God, not the things of this world. He kept on his feet. Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 8, says this. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham's walk of faith in this world meant that he never settled down. He knew what this meant when God called him, that he needed to leave his family, his land, his jobs, whatever they were, and go somewhere that God was calling him. And you know what? He never backed out of that. Abraham made plenty of other issues. He had plenty of problems. But one thing is clear. He kept on his feet. He kept on his feet. He lived in such a way that this world was not his home. All the way up to this text, he says, I'm a foreigner here. I'm just passing through. I'm still on the move to wherever that is. Abraham certainly built altars, but he never built cities. He lived in tents his whole life. He always looked ahead to what God was doing. Most of the promises that were given to Abraham, most of them would not be fully revealed for hundreds of years later. And that's what Abraham looked forward to in the spirit. He looked even beyond his own death and said, God is doing something with me. He's leading me somewhere for the sake of generations to come. And he didn't settle. He didn't stop moving. He didn't give up. He continued to press forward. And along with that, my next point is Abraham touched the things of this world very lightly. His only recorded investment is this tomb. And here we have Abraham. He would be 147 years old at this point. His only recorded investment is this tomb. So in the death of his wife, he makes this one purchase. We got to remind ourselves that there's a lot of stuff out here that is tempting to get our hands on, to bring into our homes, to give us a better life. We can't be impressed with this stuff. Abraham wasn't impressed with the stuff of the world. He wasn't a collector. He wasn't a hoarder. He wasn't buying things just because they were on sale. He wasn't filling his home with so much stuff that his garage was impossible to open. And then he had to start renting storage units. That's not how he lived. He touched the things of this world very lightly. Peter says in chapter 2 of his first letter, "Beloved, I urge you, as aliens and strangers, to abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against your soul." Peter's saying, hey, listen, just like Abraham, Christian, disciple, you are just passing through this world, and you need to be very careful that you're not becoming attached to it, that your roots aren't going down too far. You need to make sure you're staying on your feet and that your touch of this world is light, is light. Let me remind you what Jesus said, Matthew chapter 6. "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, your heart will be also." So Abraham touched lightly the things of this world. Similarly, my next point. In times of stress, Abraham didn't go back to his old life. He didn't go back to his own life. I want you to think about the situation. Abraham's wife had died, and he had no land. He had no physical home. And I would imagine, just thinking through, what would be my temptation to do? Well, I think the temptation would be is go back to my family who have a home, who have land, and bury my wife there. But he doesn't do that. He maintains hold on the promise that God made him. God told him to go out from his family, out from his land, and Abraham, in great distress and difficulty, does not double back. He doesn't go back home. I think if we're all honest, it's during the times of emotional difficulty and stress, the upsetting nature of change, that will oftentimes drive us back to the familiar. Now, that's all fine and good unless the familiar is something that God has told you to depart from. We need to be careful with that. Whatever God pulled you out of, whatever he told you to leave, whatever relationship he told you to shut down, whatever job he told you to walk away from, even the family, yes, sometimes the family that God has said, you need to take that down 7 notches in your dealings with your family, even that. In times of duress or stress, oftentimes we will very quickly be tempted to go back to those things for their comfort, for their ease of access, for the alleviation that they can bring. And don't get me wrong, that's all real, that alleviation. I understand that. But the problem comes is when we go back to something that God has told us to go out from. And Abraham didn't do that. Now, he carries on some level of a relationship with his extended family. We know this. He hears about their well-being just at the end of the last chapter, 22. He hears all about his extended family and all the sons that were there. And he's going to send his servant to go find Rebekah in the next chapter. But the truth is, he never actually goes back home. Home doesn't have the same meaning for Abraham anymore. His home is ahead of him. It is not behind. And for those of us who God has called out of situations, relationships, and yes, from our families, some of us, where is your home? Will it only take a catastrophic incident in your life to send you back to that relationship God told you to get out of? To the lucrative deal? To the comfortable home? If you're able to do that, then you're saying you're able to abandon discipleship and following Jesus. Because if he's called you away from that, That was a permanent calling. And your home should be now with the family of God and with the mission of God. And in reality, your home's in the future with Him. That's truly home. Have you settled in a mind that you actually are a stranger here? That you're a foreigner? That you're just passing through? Or is there somewhere that you would run back to? A home that you would long for? Lastly, point eight, Abraham possessed the land in faith. And this is really at the core of the entire story. The reason why this chapter is in your Bible is primarily for this. This transaction that happened, this legal exchange between Ephron and Abraham is critical to the history of the Jews. They could point back to this point in history and say, we obtained this legally. It was not through trickery. It was not through subversion. It's not from war or taking control. And interestingly, this wasn't even by a miracle of God. In this story, we have Abraham possessing the land that was expected to be his. But the bottom line was, it was a very normal part of his life. Why do I bring this up? Very often, issues of faith mean living out our life in the most normal of circumstances, but just doing it the right way. And that's what Abraham was doing. It was the death of his wife. It was the death of his longtime love. Instead of freaking out, instead of running back home, instead of making a rash decision, perhaps Abraham has learned to continue to walk in faith. And he takes very normal, very meager steps to begin to apprehend the vision and the promise that God has given him. This is going to be much of our lives, Christian. Patiently walking out the plan that God has put before you. We sure like the excitement. The last chapter, Abraham taking his son up on the mountain for an execution. That's pretty exciting, crazy, wild stuff, and that's going to change your life too. But all the times in between, the decades, we need to carefully, faithfully, patiently walk out the promise of God in faith, because that's how he possessed the land. That's how we'll possess it too. The things God has called you to, the promises he's given you, very often they will be won through obedience. They'll be won through obedience. So as you wrap this up, yes, it's true that Abraham's life wasn't a storybook. At least not in the world's eyes. But it certainly is for us, isn't it? When we read the story, the difficulty, the trials, the successes, the promises that Abraham was able to experience in his life. I think the biggest thing Abraham has to show us in this passage is that we, just like him, if we are following Jesus as disciples, we are just passing through this earth. You, my friend, are a stranger and a foreigner. And we need to remember that. We're all just travelers, looking forward to the better things in the future, the hope that lies in heaven ultimately. I'll read this in closing, Hebrews chapter 11, speaking of Abraham, Sarah, and others. It says, all of these died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, they were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, If they had called to mind the country to which they had come out of, they would have had opportunity to return there. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. He has prepared a city for them. Let's all stand and pray.